United States says Iran is poised to send Russia lethal drones for its war against Ukraine.
The Iranian government is preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred UAVs, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline.
Plus, Amnesty International gathers evidence of war crimes committed in Ukraine by Russia.
They have documented massive violations perpetrated against Ukrainians.
And later in the program, Russia stops the flow of natural gas to Western Europe through a key pipeline for maintenance. But there is concern exports might not resume soon. Today is Tuesday, July 12th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Herman. The death toll continues to rise in a collapsed apartment block hit by Russian rocket fire in the Donetsk region town of Chasiv-Yar. Emergency services officials there say they have now found 35 bodies, including one of a child, and rescue work is still continuing with more than 320 tons of rubble cleared. Authorities say 9 people have been found alive in the debris. The attack Saturday was an act of terrorism. That's how the Ukrainian president's office is terming it, accusing Russia of deliberately targeting civilians. Moscow says its forces destroyed a temporary deployment point for a Ukrainian territorial defense unit in Chasiv-Yar. The United States believes Iran is preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred drones, unmanned aerial vehicles, including some that are weapons capable. That's according to U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, who told reporters about this Monday during the daily White House press briefing.
Our information indicates that the Iranian government is preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred UAVs, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Our information further indicates that Iran is preparing to train Russian forces to use these UAVs, with initial training sessions slated to begin as soon as early July. It's unclear whether Iran has delivered any of these UAVs to Russia already.
Sullivan noted Iran had provided similar unmanned aerial vehicles to Yemen's Houthi rebels before a ceasefire was reached earlier this year.
But this is just one example of how Russia is looking to countries like Iran for capabilities that are also being used, I might add, or have been used before we got the ceasefire in place in Yemen, to attack Saudi Arabia. So from our perspective, we will continue to do our part to help sustain the effective defense of Ukraine and to help the Ukrainians show that the Russian effort to try to wipe Ukraine off the map cannot succeed.
The revelation about the Iranian drones for Russia came on the eve of President Joe Biden's trip to Israel and Saudi Arabia, where Iran's nuclear program and its other activities in the region are to be a subject of discussion. Meanwhile, the Kremlin announced Tuesday that next week Russian President Vladimir Putin will travel to Iran, the arch-rival of Saudi Arabia. In the Islamic Republic, Putin, according to Russian officials, will meet not only with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, but also with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Turkish leader has been mediating between Moscow and Kiev, and Erdogan and Putin recently discussed by phone efforts to safely facilitate grain exports from Ukraine. Turkey's defense minister announced Tuesday a meeting for the following day in Ankara on the grain issue involving Turkey, Russia, Ukraine, and a UN delegation. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. The president of the West Central African nation of Cameroon, Paul Biya, says his government will increase funding to grow more wheat after protests over shortages and price spikes sparked by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Prior to Russia's blockade of the Black Sea, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff has led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread, as Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde in Cameroon.
Cameroon government says President Paul Biya on Monday ordered an immediate disbursement of over $15 million to grow wheat in the Central African state. Gabriel Mbarobi is Cameroon's agriculture minister. He says Biya responded to pleas from civilians that the cost of living is becoming very high and many Cameroonians are finding it very difficult to put food on the table.
Les statistiques révèlent que chaque Camerounais consomme 33 kilos.
Mbarobi says Russia's war in Ukraine has completely disrupted supply chains of consumer goods, especially wheat, which is the main staple food in Cameroon. He says investing in wheat production is a wise decision because each Cameroonian consumes 33 kilograms of wheat each year, which is far more than 23 kilograms of rice each Cameroonian eats annually. He says wheat can be grown in several places in Cameroon. The government says Cameroon produces less than one-fourth of the 1.6 million tons of wheat it needs each year. Last year, the government imported more than 850,000 tons from Russia and Ukraine. Now, according to the Cameroon Importers Union, up to 25,000 tons have been imported since January 2022. Mbarobi says while the nation waits for its own newly planted wheat to be harvested before the end of the year, local substitutes like sweet potato, cassava, and yams should replace the wheat Cameroon imports from Russia and Ukraine. Cameroon says while baking bread, bakers should replace imported wheat with local substitutes such as cassava, yams, and potato. Biya's instructions for more than $15 million to be invested to grow more wheat comes after several weeks of nationwide protests against cereal shortages. The shortage of wheat has led to a close to 50% increase in the price of bread. Delon Magelin Kamsi Kamgeng is the president of Cameroon's Consumers League. He says his league organized the protest to force the government to take immediate actions that will reduce growing hunger and anger among civilians.
Le COVID a eu des conséquences qui sur le marché international.
Kamgeng says after COVID-19, Russia's war in Ukraine is leading to severe food shortages and unprecedented hikes in the prices of imported staple foods like cereals. He says people are hungry and unable to afford bread, which is consumed by a majority of households in Cameroon. Kamgeng says the government should dialogue with its citizens and take measures that will stop a looming famine. The UN reports that 1.7 billion people in 107 economies, including 41 African countries, are exposed to either rising food prices, rising energy prices, or tightening financial conditions as a result of Russia's war in Ukraine. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
We've heard a lot in the past week or so about the accession of Sweden and Finland into NATO. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to talk more about this is William Alberg, the Director of Strategy, Technology, and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Thank you and welcome to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine, William.
Thank you, Stephen.
We heard a lot about this word accession, and some people might be under the mistaken impression that NATO now has two new countries, but it isn't that easy, right?
Well, no, that's right. So what has happened is the alliance has agreed to Sweden and Finland's letter of interest to join. They had preliminary talks to decide what, if any, political, legal, and budgetary matters would be part of their membership. And then they signed what's called the Protocols of Accession. So this is a three-article, very short piece of paper that says Sweden and Finland join the NATO alliance. They adopt all the provisions of the North Atlantic Treaty. And then the rest of it is all about when it enters into force. Basically, what happens next is these protocols go to the 30 capitals, and every capital has to ratify it. Every ally has a different ratification process. And even within those processes, some have created expedited processes just for Finland and Sweden, because there's a recognition of a period of vulnerability for Sweden and Finland in between the time that they've been accepted to apply for membership and ratification. It's feared that Russia might do something bad in the meantime. That's why the UK and the US have given them certain security guarantees.
What's your estimate on the timeline? And you might want to talk about Turkey as well, because they have to sign off on this too.
We figure most of them are going to be really quick. One thing of real interest is the US. So for the US, this protocol has to go from the State Department to the president with a little report. The president then puts a letter on it and sends it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee have to bless it and rate the actual articles of accession for the Senate to consider. And then full Senate has to vote on it. And you have to have two-thirds of the Senate approve it to provide what we call advice and consent. And then they deposit it with themselves and it's then ratified. Will the Senate come back in session? Right now, they're not scheduled to come back into session until early September. It could be that they call a special session as soon as it's ready and ratify it right away. We'll see. But as you point out, the big question is Turkey. So Turkey stopped this process dead right at the start, even though Sweden and Finland had both asked Erdogan personally. President Niinistö of Finland had spoken with Erdogan and other high-level Turkish officials, and they said, no, there'll be no problem. And then yet, Turkey stopped the process and made certain demands, including on terrorism, on the Kurds, etc. And there was a real fear that they would stop every stage of the process. Fortunately, on July the 4th, they indicated they would lift those restrictions and let it go to accession. But there's still a question. The Turkish parliament's not going to meet until, I think it's October. Will they come back in special session? Yes, no. And then they're going into an election season. Will they try to delay this until after the election? So now the question is, what leverage do people have to make sure that Turkey keeps moving this forward? And of course, the U.S. has a considerable amount of leverage because Turkey wants modernized, upgraded F-16s. And this has sort of been part of the shadow play here. In the meantime, Greece is searching for F-35 approval. So all of this is in play right now. The U.S. has a couple cards they can play here. But the more allies ratify quickly, if you have 25, 26, 27 allies all waiting on Turkey, that increases the pressure on them and decreases the benefit for them to just delay this.
The reaction in Moscow has been surprisingly understated. They've sort of shrugged this off. Is that just for appearance sake, or how do you think they really feel about this in the Kremlin?
The Kremlin has been saying for years that NATO approaching its borders is its greatest threat. If you read their national security strategy, they say specifically that an enlarging NATO is a direct threat to Russia. And part of the excuse for them to invade and try to rip apart Ukraine is NATO enlargement, right? And yet, Sweden and Finland join, and Russia says it's not really a problem. I think there's two reasons for this. Number one, I think he realizes that the Finns really are excellent at defending themselves. They don't necessarily need NATO membership in terms of defending their territory. It's a wonderful thing to help them and to make sure that they're protected. So I think the realization, the speed with which, and the unity of society, not just Finland with 70% of the population now supporting NATO membership, but in Sweden, also joining them around in the high 60s, unprecedented poll numbers. And I think once Putin sees that there's no benefit in pushing you, he doesn't hit you where you're strong, he hits you where you're weak. Here's the other problem. One of the reasons Sweden and Finland wanted to do this now is because the entire Russian army is bogged down in a conflict that it doesn't look like they're going to win against Ukraine that's incredibly highly motivated. And a lot of those units are being pulled from Baltic bases, from Kaliningrad and from the St. Petersburg area. So actually, this is the perfect time for them to join because Russia simply doesn't have the forces to threaten Finland or Sweden in place right now and likely will need years to reconstitute. We might hear some nuclear rhetoric. I think they might say, we're going to put nuclear weapons in Kaliningrad or Pskov. And they're already there. They're just going to admit to them and call it a new thing. And I think they're going to rely more on nuclear deterrence for security, because it's kind of like in the Cold War, when we were worried about the Soviet superiority, so we relied a lot on tactical nuclear weapons. It's not going to have any teeth to it, and everything in that region will calm down immeasurably. The Finnish report on accession to NATO actually says joining NATO will reduce the chance of conflict in the Baltic region to near zero, and I believe that that's absolutely correct.
William Alberg in Berlin, Director of Strategy, Technology, and Arms Control at IISS. Thank you for your insight.
Thanks for having me on.
Ukraine says it has carried out a long-range rocket strike against Russian forces, destroying an ammunition dump in the town of Novokharkovka in the Kherson region and killing 52 Russians. A Russian-installed official there says at least 7 people had been killed and that civilians and civilian infrastructure had been hit. VOA News is unable to independently verify the conflicting claims. As Moscow's military continues to pound Ukrainian cities with missiles, the Russian president has signed a decree expanding a fast-track procedure for Ukrainians to obtain Russian citizenship. Until recently, only residents of Ukraine's eastern Donetsk and Luhansk regions, as well as those in several other areas now under Russian control, were eligible to apply for the simplified passport procedure. The decree also applies for any stateless residents currently in Ukraine, according to Russian media. Ukraine's foreign ministry says the move is an encroachment on Ukrainian sovereignty and inconsistent with the principles of international law. The ministry says Ukraine's international partners should step up supplies of heavy weapons to Kyiv to punish Moscow for this action. For the international non-governmental organization Amnesty International, Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine has been a priority since the invasion in late February. In an interview with VOA's United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir, the organization's Secretary General, Agnes Callamard, explained the group has had personnel on the ground from shortly after the time of the Russian invasion.
They have documented massive violations perpetrated against Ukrainians, including indiscriminate attacks against Ukrainian civilians, act of torture, act of ill treatment, extrajudicial executions, and report of sexual violence, to mention just a few. The most common, I will say, violations and war crime that we have investigated has been indiscriminate targeting of civilian subjects, including buildings. Myself, I was in several of those buildings in Bonodienka and in Bucha, and I met with the resident that had escaped. I saw the damage that was done. It's very difficult to conclude in any other ways but that those were war crimes committed by the Russian artillery. We have most recently also conducted a very in-depth investigation into the attacks of the theater in Mariupol, and there we have concluded that the Russian militaries have deliberately targeted civilians and civilians' objects. A multitude of war crimes being perpetrated.
Callamard, previously the special rapporteur for extrajudicial executions appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council, says Amnesty International will continue to contribute to accountability and delivery of justice in response to these crimes in Ukraine.
In addition, Amnesty International is also very keen to ensure that the Ukrainian justice system, that the International Criminal Court systems are able to work to the best of their capacity so that justice could be delivered. So Amnesty will also focus on some of the trials that are likely to take place in Ukraine. We will monitor very closely the effort and the steps taken by the International Criminal Court. The response of the ICC to Ukraine stands in many ways as an example of what we would expect an international criminal court to be able to do. They were fast, they were committed, they were on the ground very quickly, and they all said the right thing. We want what they've done in Ukraine to become a model for other similar massive human rights violation situations.
The Kremlin is using natural gas as a weapon in response to European Union sanctions over Ukraine. That's the assessment of Germany's economy minister, Robert Habeck, who is warning Europeans to brace for the possibility that natural gas shipments won't resume from Russia after supplies via a Baltic Sea pipeline were suspended. The flow of gas to Germany through the Nord Stream 1 pipeline was halted to Germany for 10 days from Monday for annual maintenance work. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine to discuss this is Elizabeth Wishnick, a senior research scientist at the Center for Naval Analyses here in the United States and a political science professor on leave from Montclair State University. Thank you for being here on today's program.
Hello, it's my pleasure to join you today.
First of all, Liz, do you agree with the assessment of the German economy minister about Russia using natural gas as a political weapon in Europe?
Yes, I think that we've seen this happen for several months already. So Russia has already cut the flow of gas to Germany. By some indications, it's now at 40% of expected supply. Some have said 60%. So there certainly has been a slowdown in supply so far. And the fear is that this normal maintenance will be the prelude to a further cutoff or perhaps even a suspension.
The Canadian government says it will return a repaired turbine to Germany for the Nord Stream 1 pipeline. That decision has angered the government of Ukraine, which accuses Canada of adjusting the sanctions imposed on Moscow to the whims of Russia. The U.S. State Department says it supports Canada's decision. It looks like, Liz, we have an open disagreement between Kiev and some of its biggest supporters in its war against Russia.
Well, I think that this wasn't the whim of Russia. I think Germany wanted more time to build its gas reserves. The EU ministers recently approved regulations that require all countries to have 80% of their needed gas supplies by November 1st. And Germany has been on track to comply with that regulation, and it stands at 64% of needed supplies. And so what Germany was hoping to do was to accumulate those supplies, and then it would be in a better position should the EU decide to reduce further gas imports from Russia. Of course, Kyiv is upset about this. They would like faster EU action on energy imports, because that is really the main card that the West has against Russia. Other sanctions have not been biting as much as hoped. And energy is how Russia finances its war against Ukraine.
And finally, Germany is not the only country vulnerable to the whims of the Kremlin on the flow of gas through Nord Stream 1. Italy is also getting less supply from Russia as well. Obviously, this will become more of a problem if there are restrictions come winter in Europe. Is the continent prepared for those possible seasonal shortages?
I think the Russian war on Ukraine has been a wake-up call for the EU about energy dependence on Russia, especially for countries like Germany and Italy. They are not as prepared as they might be. Germany is rushing to complete an LNG terminal to have an alternative source of gas. They've been increasing supplies from Norway and the Netherlands. Germany's been talking about resuming use of coal in violation of climate pledges. I think the hope was that engagement with Russia would help moderate its political demands, and that proved not to be the case. And so hopefully, finally, there will be better strategy for the long term, both to reduce dependence on Russia and to find more sources of green energy to comply with climate imperatives.
Elizabeth Wishnick from the Center for Naval Analyses, thank you for joining us on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
Thank you.
We end with some good news for Ukraine's healthcare workers. An additional $1.7 billion is on the way to help pay them and other essential workers in the country. The money is coming from the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. Treasury Department, and the World Bank. USAID says the funds are meant to alleviate the acute budget deficit caused by Russia's brutal war of aggression. And that's it for today's program. I'm VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman. Good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.